from Cambridge.
I'm from Cambridge. I'm from Cambridge. My student's also from Cambridge. This is work done with Joao Leia. Let me tell you what aspects I'm going to talk about. This is kind of a cheap title where I don't actually give any information. The work I'm going to tell you about involves basically two things. One is understanding some renormalization group flows for fermionic operators. And the other one is understanding or looking at a new way to implement non-relativistic fermions in a holographic context. So there's been a lot of work on looking at non-relativistic field theories, typically by changing the background geometry from an ADS geometry to something like Lifshitz or Schrodinger. But we're not going to do that here. This is actually going to be looking at non-relativistic fields, but where the Lorentz violation comes purely from boundary conditions that you put in ADS. We're going to see that there's some interesting features that arise, most notably something that's called a flat band. And so the end of the talk will be explaining what this flat band is. I should also say that I'm going to use this as a little bit of a platform to explain some very, very simple things about fermions in ADS to begin with, partially to set the scene for the talk that that Joe and Hong are going to give Wednesday, I guess. Thursday. So that means that the experts, the first 15 minutes, is going to be really tedious. And it's really for the people that have never looked at a Dirac equation in ADS before, just so I can explain some basic things. Okay, so let me start with the picture that, yes, everybody starts with. This is ADS. To set the conventions, the metric we'll use is is the following. That means that the boundary of ADS, which is the UV, exists at R equals 0, and the infrared way down here is R goes to infinity. It's slightly annoying talking about fermions because the Clifford algebra takes sort of different structures in every dimension, which means that to write some of these equations, I'm going to have to specify almost immediately to some specific dimension, even though all the formulae that I'll actually derive will be valid in any dimension. So what I'm going to do is specify to ADS4. That means that the boundary theory is a D equals 2 plus 1 dimensional theory, equals 3 dimensions. But I think it's a true statement that anywhere there's a 3 in any formulae, if you replace that by D, you get the right answer. Okay, so we're going to be looking at Dirac fields. And there's going to be a Dirac spinner in the bulk. This is a 4D Dirac spinner, which means, of course, that it has four components. And through the gauge gravity duality dictionary, this is going to be dual to an operator in the 2 plus 1 dimensional boundary theory. And this operator is going to be a 3D Dirac spinner. So a 3D Dirac spinner has two components. The three-dimensional Clifford algebra is just two-dimensional. This means that I've cheated already. This alpha is not the same thing as this alpha. Okay. Exactly why a 4D Dirac spinner becomes sort of half its components to a 3D Dirac spinner, I'll explain shortly. Okay, let me just stress, because I think this ties in certainly with something that Sean was talking about last week and that may be touched upon in the discussion that Joe and Hong are going to give. This operator here, as always, is some composite gauge invariant operator in some boundary field theory. So roughly speaking, this operator is something like the trace of, in inverted commas, of something like an adjoint fermion with an adjoint scalar on the boundary. Okay, this is important because we'll be looking at Green's functions for this thing. We'll be seeing that there are Fermi surfaces. not so much in this talk, but certainly on Thursday, that there are Fermi surfaces that arise from this. It's not a Fermi, well, it's not explicitly a Fermi surface for these lambdas. You don't really see Fermi surfaces for these gauge variant quantities directly, always this gauge invariant. Okay, so the action for a Dirac spinner in ADS is the following. Okay, so this derivative acts on that guy, this derivative acts on that guy. I've chosen to write it in this form because it's sort of a nice Hermitian version of the action. I could, of course, integrate by parts to put both derivatives acting on this guy. But importantly, when you integrate by parts in ADS, you pick up boundary terms that come from this boundary at r equals 0. And reflecting that is that even for this form of the action, it has to be augmented by some boundary term at r equals 0, which gives rise to a well-defined variational principle. Okay. This boundary term, I should stress, is perhaps the most important object in this whole talk, but I'm not actually going to write it down explicitly, unless people clamor for me to do it. It's nothing complicated. It's things like psi bar psi with very specific coefficients, but it's not particularly illuminating to tell you concretely what it is. If people ask later.
So this is the Euclidean signature?
No, this is, it could be Euclidean or Lorentzian, but I'm going to work in Lorentzian.
No, I mean the first
one. No, because this I sits in front, it's because I'm in minus plus. Sorry?
No,
because I'm in minus plus plus plus, there's a gamma zero in here which squares to minus one, and so that's why this guy is there. Okay. Questions? So let's see where this boundary term, why this boundary term is necessary. Well, when I derive the equations of motion from this action, of course I vary psi bar, I vary psi. For both of them, I have terms that have derivatives hitting the delta psi now. And as usual, when you do Euler-Lagrange equations, I have to integrate by parts. But when I integrate by parts, this boundary term remains, and I want this term to cancel part of the boundary term that arises from here. So the full variational principle is well defined. I'll explain shortly exactly what we need to make this variational principle well defined. Okay, so the Dirac equation, assuming you can pick a good boundary term, is simply the following. It's particularly useful to choose the gamma matrix in the radial direction. I mean, that way, so this is sort of 4, which is the same as the R direction, to be of this form. And when you do that, you solve these Dirac equations. You can solve them exactly in ADS. Bessel functions, as always in ADS. But in particular, it's useful to look at them close to the boundary, so what the solutions look like close to here. And when you do that, you find the following form. This is an example where you can replace 3 by D if you so choose. This is a 4-component spinner. That means that A and D are both 2-component spinners. Okay. Any questions? Does this seem to be clear? Good. Now something slightly different happens for fermions than would happen for scalars in ADS. Let me just spend a minute to stress this. If this were a scalar equation, what you would do is the following. You would fix the leading order terms and interpret those as sources for the boundary operator, you would then integrate this equation all the way into the infrared. There'd be some boundary conditions on the infrared that you would impose. You'll then follow the solution back out, and the subleading terms that sit here you would interpret as the response of that operator, the expectation value of the operator. Okay? That's for scalars. That's not what you do for fermions. And the reason is the following. The reason is that the system for fermions is first order rather than second order. That means that on the boundary, when you're here, if you were to specify both A and D, you've specified both position and momentum for those fermions. You specified all the boundary conditions that you could ever have. You don't then get to say anything about what's going on in the infrared. So the upshot for fermions is that rather than fixing both A and D on the boundary, you pick just one. And you fix just one, that's the source, and the other guy you interpret as the response. Okay. That, by the way, is then the role of this boundary condition, this boundary term here. It's to guarantee that when you do the variational principle, it's either A or D that is fixed on the boundary. Is that clear?
I'm sorry, it sounded like you said the same thing for the fermions and scalars.
No, sorry, so for the... Oh, I see.
Scalars, you said you fix one, you solve the equation, and you determine the other.
Yeah, so for the scalars, you would fix the thing with the leading fall-off, and then the sub-leading guys here in the dot, dot, dots, you would interpret as the response. Okay. Here, I guess it's not too dissimilar because this is subleading to this, but it's also a different component of the field. So you fix two components of the field and their leading behavior, and then the leading behavior of the other two components is the response. Okay. Are there any other questions? It's a basic point, but it's kind of important for what.
In the dual field theory, one of those things is falling off more slowly towards infinity than the other.
Yes.
Do we interpret the coefficient that falls off more slowly as being the operator perturbation and the other one as the BEV, or is the dictionary different?
No, it's exactly the same, and I'll stress that. Other questions?
Well, so this is equivalent to saying you're talking about the retarded Green's function?
No, the retarded Green's function comes from a discussion of which boundary conditions you place in the infrared, so the ingoing boundary conditions.
This is probably a dumb question, but how do you impose that you're talking about a causal effect as opposed to...
By the ingoing boundary conditions, yeah.
But I thought you said you couldn't impose them.
Sorry. Yeah, let me say again. Had I imposed, fixed both A and D at the boundary, then I wouldn't have any choice for the infrared. That would be determining everything. So what I do is... What is done is you fix just either A or D. Let's fix A. D is free to fluctuate, so A plus ingoing boundary conditions.
Veronica.
And then for the
scalar field, at this stage, there's no role for the subleading
component. No, not so much. I mean, this does play the role of the subleading. Okay, so what do we do? The usual choice. Is the following. Let's fix a sign for the mass, and we'll choose m equals 0. As Shamit stressed, for m equals 0, this term falls off more slowly than this term. In particular, if m is bigger than 3/2, this goes as 1 over r to some power. This term is blowing up at the boundary. This term is going to 0. So this is the term that we should fix. So you fix A alpha, and interpret that as the source for some operator. In particular, the CFT on the boundary, you turn A alpha on. Now has this extra term added, which is a source for this fermionic operator. Okay, we now fix some infrared boundary conditions, which is ingoing for retarded causal Green's functions, as was first stressed by Son and Andre Staranets. And then, okay, so you fix this, you integrate into the interior of ADS, you fix the boundary conditions in the interior, you then come back out and read off what d alpha is from that differential equation. And D is interpreted up to some coefficient, which I won't specify, as the response to this source, so the expectation value of this fermion operator. Okay, so note that the dimension of the operator, you can read off from the fall-off, and it's the fall-off of the D component, so the dimension is given by 3/2 plus ML, which I'll also call later in the talk. Again, this is a situation where 3 you can replace by D, and you get the right answer in all dimensions.
Do you get this club and outwitten business of alternative possibilities for delta?
This is exactly what the remainder of this talk is going to be about, what possibilities you can have.
M equals 0, they both have the same fall-off?
That's right, for M equals 0, they both have the same fall-off.
Is there a minus?
No, that's right. They have the same fall-off and will, and that will be a special case of what we're about to talk about.
But there's a log.
No. There's no log for fermions. For scalars, there would be, but not. Yeah, for M equals 0, this is dimension 3/2, psi bar psi is exactly marginal, at least in the large N limit. Okay, other questions? So finally, with this, we're in a position where we can compute the Green's functions. This was really explained in beautiful detail by in a lovely paper by Nabil Iqbal and Hong Liu. And it's the usual story, but you just have to take some care about what's really going on with retarded versus advanced. The Green's function is just the relationship between the source and the response. And I think if I've got the factors of gamma 0 right, gamma 0, alpha, beta.
So you see the question.
Yeah.
The conventional field theory, the field theory, this would have been a dimension 1 operator.
That's right. Yeah.
So why is it magic here? Because it's a CFT, is that the...
So if you set... So this is never a marginal operator, this is the dimension. If M is 0...
Yes.
The double trace operation is marginal, psi bar psi would be marginal. But typically, at least in this case, for M bigger than 0, psi bar psi is an irrelevant operator. And it's just different from free field theory, it's strongly interacting. Okay, question. So this is the Green's function. This thing that sits here. There's a gamma 0 there because the Green's function is psi dagger psi rather than psi bar psi base. That's the Green's function. Okay, so just to spell it out, if you were to do this procedure just in ABS, you could solve the Dirac equation exactly in ABS. You find that the Green's function is that's basically fixed by some formality for a spinner operator, it takes the following form. 0 is k squared. And I guess I've written this for k squared less than 0 momentum. Okay, so it's got some spinner structure, just k dotted with sigma, as you might expect. And this is really just fixed by scale invariance, and there's some overall. This was first written down long, long ago by Henningsen and Svetsos and Muck and Vishwan. Okay, good. Missed an "an." Right back in the 90s when ADS CFT first did this. Okay, one reason for stressing this is I suspect that in Hong's discussion, he's going to talk about computations of this Green's function, when you heat the system up by looking at an ADS black hole, and you put the system at finite chemical potential by making the ADS black hole charged. So when you do that, this was a calculation that Sung-sik was the first to do, you find that this Green's function gives very, very strong evidence for a Fermi surface. There are poles in the Green's function at zero frequency, and finite momenta. This was then explored in great detail by many people in this room, the MIT group, Hong, Nabil, Tom Faulkner, David Vey, and John McGreevy, and the Leiden group as well. Okay, that sort of ends my community service of just explaining these very basic issues. People want to ask questions about this before I move on and tell you some newer things.
Since everything has been so clear, I mean, your little gammas and your capital gammas?
Yeah, so these guys are four-dimensional, and little gammas are three-dimensional. Just to complete this, I think that 0, gamma mu, that for the boundary conditions, that works.
The question was symmetry. In four dimensions, you would have symmetry, which is a right kind of symmetry. And in three dimensions, which is diverse.
The three-dimensional story with, in particular, parity and time reversal, we'll get into a little later in the talk. It's worth mentioning briefly about chiral symmetry. Chiral symmetry in the bulk you only get when the mass vanishes. However, it's broken by boundary conditions. So there's a local chiral symmetry, but the fact you have to pick A alpha as the thing you fix on the boundary breaks that chiral symmetry. Yes, but only at the boundary.
Doesn't that become parity and time reversal breaking at boundary?
No. It's perfectly fine on the. That doesn't break any of the three-dimensional symmetries. There is a remnant of this on the boundary, and I think maybe I'll talk about that a little later. If you ask me the question again, if I forget, Max.
If m is equal to 0, what is the reason to fix A alpha? It looks like, you know, they come with the same power laws. Yeah. Can't you believe in some kind of...
You're absolutely right. So if m is equal to 0, you could fix A alpha, or you could fix D alpha, or you could fix some linear combination of them. The option to fix D alpha is actually there for different values of m as well, and that's what I'll talk about now.
I see. But can you try to do it in some kind of... way to preserve.
Good. So actually, maybe I can answer Eduardo's question now. When m is 0, you can actually take linear combinations of A alpha and D alpha that are fixed on the boundary. That means that you don't just have one conformal field theory, you have sort of a circle's worth of conformal field theories, by choosing which one you pick. That circle's worth is arising because the psi bar psi, that operator has dimension 3, so it's a marginal operator. So when you turn it on, you move around that circle. So that's actually what happens to chiral symmetry in the bulk, is that it becomes a circle of fixed points in the boundary.
Can you choose m to be 3 halves over L or something? Do you get a Lorentz breaking marginal perturbation that you can use to get some weird theory? Hmm.
3 halves?
Whatever it would be to make psi alpha of dimension 3.
It's a fermionic perturbation.
Yeah.
Well, cool. No, but it's Grassmann, so it's weird, right?
Yeah, of course it'd be weird.
We'll see Lorentz breaking deformations, but slightly more subtle ones. Yeah.
I mean, there is just a single, following up on the previous question of the fixing combination. Mm-hmm. And if there's a circle's worth of possibilities, but just a single bulk, does that mean that the circle's worth of possibilities is just mapping, it's just re-expressing the same physics in different languages, which makes it look like a different CFT, or?
No, I think it's genuinely a different CFT it's a different CFT in the sense that you get from one to the other by adding a marginal operator. However, I think it's also true that because it came from a symmetry in the bulk, the correlation functions in those CFTs are sort of related in some way. Other questions? Yeah, so what happens if you do vial fermions, you've just got this guy, right? You've still got to fix just half of it. So the only way you can do that in a way consistent with the boundary Lorentz symmetry is to split it into real and imaginary parts. Think of it as two Majorana fermions. So a vial fermion in four dimensions translates to a Majorana fermion in the boundary. There was another question, Giuseppe.
Yes, you mentioned if you get the Fermi support for the square vectors from side to side, can you make exactly that there is a Fermi surface for this fermion or And I think you can only say that there is a Fermi surface for some fermion which has non-zero overlap with this, that is, the big function is non-zero.
I'm not sure I fully understand. So you compute this Green's function for psi. You see a zero frequency pole at some Fermi momentum. What's the statement then?
I'm asking what statement from that concerning that there is a Fermi surface for some operator. I don't know if this question makes sense. You see what I'm saying? If there is, it could be that the fermion that makes up the Fermi surface is not exactly psi, but some other fermion that just has some non-zero overlap.
I guess, only you thinking in particular about
gauge invariant.
You're right.
I don't know. Yeah, for example, one could ask the Fermi surface for lambda. Since it's some gauge invariant, that's not a well-defined question.
Yeah, and certainly this whole issue about, you know, Luttinger counts not working is because they're missing, presumably, Fermi surfaces for these guys. Okay, yeah, Mike.
Right.
No, that's good.
From a 3D perspective, the moduli space is compact.
3D perspective, the moduli space meaning the line of fixed points?
Yeah, m equals 0 is compact.
Yeah.
In 4D, it seems clear from this chiral symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
From 3D perspective, it's deformed by this psi bar psi.
Mm-hmm.
Can I give it any coefficient?
The psi bar.
Psi.
Yeah, so at some, yeah, how do you realize it? You mean, how do you realize it's a circle from the 3D perspective?
Maybe this isn't important.
And it's obvious to see sort of from the bulk boundary duality, purely from the field theoretic. I don't know, is that? Yeah. Okay. Let me move on. So as Max and others have already pointed out, when M is zero, it doesn't seem like you've got any reason at all to fix A, to prefer A over D, and that's true. Actually, this happens already before M gets to zero. So you can certainly see that if M is less than 3/2, both this term and this term decay towards the boundary. This one's slower than this one, but nonetheless, they both drop off. It turns out that dropping off is not enough. What you actually need is for both of them to drop off fast enough so that the modes are normalizable. That means that if you choose not to fix them, they will fluctuate on their own. And that happens, it's easy to check, for m being less than 1/2. So another choice is what happens when ml is less than half. Okay, so both of these terms drop off suitably fast so that if you allow them to fluctuate, they will fluctuate. So as soon as you have this, you can, so both A alpha and D alpha modes are normalizable. Which means that you have a choice. You could choose not to fix A alpha and let D fluctuate, but instead to fix D and let A alpha fluctuate. You can fix D alpha and interpret this as the source. Again, with some infrared boundary conditions. And then A alpha then gets the role of the response. So the role of D and A get flipped.
In the scalar case, we had these two values. It wasn't really true that both are normalizable, but it's always only one that's normalizable, but which one it is, it depends on what boundary terms I added. Is this the same here?
No, I think in the scalar case, they're also both normalized. If you just follow the fall-offs.
But if you put it back into the action, you get an infinity for one of them, and which one it is depends on whether you have a kinetic term, which was defined.
Yeah, that's true. I think another way of saying it is you need to fix your boundary conditions so that the variational principle fixes for you, in this case, either A or D, or in the scalar case,
Dirichlet.
Or said another way, the variational principle only allows one of them to fluctuate and not the other. The variational principle itself fixes.
And if you stick the wrong one back into the action, you get
it. Then, right, then you see that it doesn't work. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so what's going on here? What we're seeing is that the same bulk dynamics actually can give rise to two different conformal field theories on the boundary that vary just by the boundary conditions that you fix. So that this is an old story. It was understood first by Klebanov and Witten in the 1990s, a scalar case. And what's going on is just that there are two different conformal field theories related to the same bulk dynamics. They have the same operator content, but the dimensions of operators differ. And in particular, in this case, the dimension of this fermion operator differs just by a minus sign here.
David?
Yeah.
In the scalar case, of course, there's many more choices. You can fix any relation between your two.
No, not preserving conformal invariants. That gives rise to some double trace operator, which leads to an RG flow. Okay.
There is another choice which preserves conformal invariants. You can add a triple trace term.
There's some very specific value of the mass, right.
But you're maintaining conformal invariants in this loop. Oh, yeah. In fermionic case, can you also sort of...
Yeah, we can turn on double trace operators, and we will. We can play various games and actually see some new scalar invariant choices as well. So that's short. Okay, so this is a different CFT. Let me just give them some names. I'm going to call this guy CFT2, and this guy CFT1. So there's a very nice story about the relationships between these two CFTs. We see that they came from the same bulk dynamics. But about eight years ago or so, it was realized that there's actually a very, very physical relationship between this CFT and this CFT. And to see this, we really need to look at this formula here. So the dimension of the operator is 3 over 2 minus ML, and M is greater than 0. So there's a very physical relationship between these CFTs. And this comes by looking at the dimension of this operator here. Because we're in the large N limit, you just have to sum the dimensions of the two. So this is 3 minus 2 ml. In particular, it's less than 3, which means it's a relevant operator. So this nice relationship was understood by Berkouz, Schomer, and Sever, and at the same time, Witten. And the idea is the following, that you start in this CFT, and you add this relevant operator with some coefficient. And you flow under RG to the other CFT. OK, so you can get from this CFT to this one just by following this RG flow.
So this ML equals 1/2. Point is the point where the operator in CFT2 hits the entirety bound.
Exactly. So actually, at a half is not allowed. It would be free flow. Okay. So just a few points to stress. This CFT and this CFT both have very large central charges of order n squared. However, the difference between them is only of order 1. So really, only some of the operators are really being massed up, or you're only losing a very few degrees of freedom as you undergo this RG. But by the way, I don't think anybody's actually calculated the difference in the central charges between these two CFTs in the fermionic case. For scalars, it's been done long ago by Gubster and Mitra. I don't think it's been done for fermions yet.
So is there some sort of symmetry between these two CFTs?
You can relate the two correlation functions by a Legendre transform. But more physical symmetry now.
This is sort of reminiscent to problems of boundary conformal field theory in 1+1 dimensions, where they have this G theorem. And there are these two fixed points. There's a stable and unstable fixed point, same thing. Scalar, there is a T duality, essentially.
I don't know that story, but it does sound similar. Maybe others can comment on that.
This is very similar to the OM Web model. This is very similar to the OM Web model in 2+1 dimension, which we flow to the OM Web model in 2+1 dimension, which we flow from free safety to this critical one, which is exactly like this, the larger limit.
So, I mean, it sounds like the two CFTs are not sort of democratic, but one has more disappeared than the other.
That's right.
So how can they come from the same bulk? Well, how does the bulk know?
You have to do quantum effects in the bulk. So you have to compute the change in the cosmological constant from these spinner loops given these two boundary conditions, and you see that there's a difference of order one between them. So this is the calculations that's been done for scalars, but to my knowledge, at least not for fermions.
Living in the bulk and depending on how quantum effects
are
taken, one or the other.
Yeah, so you do see it, bulk.
David, so yeah. This flow happen if G has one particular sign in
no,
the beginning.
No, for fermions, positive or negative.
Either positive or negative, it goes the same.
For scalars, you have to presumably worry, but for fermions, it's okay. I'll talk more about this flow for G now.
Can you draw the flow somewhere?
Yes, I can give you the beta function.
What do you think the quantum effect, I mean, can you calculate the central charge and calculate three-point functions for gravity? Is it something about boundary conditions?
No, I think it's really, it's a 1 over n effect, because the central charge is
1 over n is 1 over charge. Charge.
Okay.
So
this change. Leaving it in the correlation functions in general, but 1 over n
is still. It's a loop correction to the three.
It's a loop correction.
To the three gravity and 3-point function.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So it was computed in the spinner case.
Oh, it was? Good. Who by?
By a student at MIT, Andrea Avery.
Oh, I know that paper. I didn't realize he. Okay. Good. Good. Okay, let me mention a few things about this RG flow, because it differs slightly from that of scalars, which has been very, very well studied. Notice in particular, and this is something Eduardo mentioned at the beginning, terms like this for fermions always break a symmetry of your theory. So in particular, this is a 2+1 dimensional theory, and this term here is going to break parity. So this is parity invariant, and this is parity invariant, but you break parity as you flow between them. So the flow breaks parity. But this is restored at the end. Okay, so what we'd like to do is try and understand more details of this flow. As I've tried to stress, this doesn't really have anything to do with the bulk. This has also to do with how the boundary conditions for the Fermi are changing. So last year, in a couple of very nice papers, Heemskerk and Joe and Mukund Hong and Tom, that's 4 out of 5 in the audience, explained how to do this, how to follow the RG flow for boundary conditions. Heemskerk, no. Is he? Hi. Sorry. David. Okay, so it's goes by the name of Wilsonian RG flow. And let's go. There's lots of possibilities to make spelling mistakes here. Anybody want to complain? Good. Okay, so roughly speaking, the idea is the following. You take these boundary conditions, lost my picture. You take these boundary conditions, and suppose that you don't look at r equals 0, you look at r equals epsilon, a little bit away from r equals 0, and these fields come in, and you want to impose some boundary conditions on that surface. So you solve the equations of motion in the bulk, and you compute all your correlation functions. Suppose now that you moved that surface in a little bit towards the infrared. And roughly speaking, the question you want to ask is, what boundary conditions do you have to impose on that surface to make sure that all the physics is invariant? And in doing that, you see that as you move down your boundary conditions, if you're not in the conformal case, but you're undergoing some flow like this, have to change as you move into the infrared. And so in doing this, these authors were able to compute beta functions for these kind of coefficients. Okay, so in this paper with Joao Leo, we just repeated this. There's a few little subtleties that make it different. And the end result is that the beta function you get is the following form. Okay, this is almost true. What happens is the beta function is of this form. G increases from very small, 0, up to 1. When G is equal to 1, it looks like this is a fixed point, but that's a fake. It's a fake because of that square root. When G is equal to 1, it actually keeps running, but at that point, you get an extra minus sign there. So you get extra minus sign after G is equal to 1. And then it flows back down to 0. Now, it had to flow back down to 0 precisely because you needed parity to be restored by the time you get to the infrared.
How did you do a calculation that you trust all the way to G equals 1?
It's just a classical calculation in the bulk. Purely classical. I don't think it's...
And there aren't like a whole tower of operators activated in addition to G along the flow?
Ah, good. You mean like higher derivative operators? Good. So the story is, if you were to also include some source here, what do we call the source? D is the source in this case. And that source depended on X. Then in this case, you're right, all these higher derivative operators turn on, and there's a more complicated formula which we have. However, if you do the flow purely in vacuum, then no, they don't.
What's the higher order term of 1 over n suppressed?
Higher order terms of 1 over n? The higher derivative operator? I don't think so. They're just psi bar. Well, it's more complicated than this.
Momentum dependence. You're talking about momentum dependence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Oh, you were thinking about sort of higher trace operators.
Yeah, I thought he was talking about the cubic.
Yeah. So if you have sort of Yukawa terms in the bulk, then higher cube bar. Triple trace, quartic trace operators, and they're 1 over n suppressed. Okay, let me just...
Draw this beta function, and can you draw the beta function and the flow?
Yeah.
You mean can we...
Can you draw it?
Yeah. I can just give you the explicit expression.
A really good question, is there some scale that is generated dynamically at 1?
No, I think...
Must be some crossover between one fixed point and the other, must be some scale.
Let me just. Let me write this, but then I'm going to actually have to go back and because I cheated a bit in my previous.
There should be some scale.
Yeah. E to the squared epsilon to the 4m. Okay, so this is the flow of G. Okay. There's a scale here. I think this is the scale that you meant. This scale is actually really this coefficient. So this coefficient is a scale. It sort of tells you how fast you start as you go. Anomalous. And nothing's anomalous. It's just that these don't have canonical free field dimensions, and this has a.
So that coupling constant means some scale.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You put it in by hand when you turned on this relevance.
Is G as a function of energy scale?
No. This is G as a function of. Well, epsilon is. Is R basically mm-hmm. where you choose to put the cuff?
And what is? Huh?
how does the right-hand side depend on epsilon? Your left-hand side is a function of epsilon?
These are epsilons, not E's.
Oh, this is epsilon.
Yeah.
Epsilon. So can you plug it? I can plug it in my head.
It looks like this. If this is epsilon is infinity, and this is epsilon is zero.
The two CFTs are different.
No, what do you mean? What can't be like that?
Yeah, it's exactly what it's like. This is G. This is G is one. So the two CFTs are, you know, it's not like in the scalar case. Let me stress the scalar, what happens for scalars, and then I'll this may be where the problem's coming from.
Is it because it flows back to zero?
Yeah, it flows back to zero.
Back to the same, but it's not the same fixed point.
No, because the operator has changed as you go along the flow. So for scalars, you could do the same thing. You could add some double trace operator like this. And roughly speaking, this is one of the key equations from these papers over there. It looks something like the following. Okay. So in particular, F equals 0 is a fixed point, but F equals 1 is another fixed point. F equals 0 and F equals 1 are the fixed points. What's more, it's quadratic, which means that it's only picking up one loop contributions, where loops here don't mean loops in Toff couplings, but loops in F, the perturbation itself. But this is actually something which agrees with large N. This was realized before by Leonardo Rastelli and Pomeroy. So there's a very nice story here.
If you compute the C function, it's not just a function of G, since then it would be a flow with no change in the central charge. If you compute the C function along your flow,
yeah,
G is returning to zero.
That's right. No, because you know to compute the central charge, you have to start doing fermionic loops in the bulk. Okay, so that's, you know, here it sort of seems natural. F flows from zero and goes to one and then stops. That's not what's happening here, and it can't happen because of the symmetries. Because this term has to vanish at the end to restore parity. So what's really going on is you're not returning to the same CFT, because the meaning of this operator, in particular the dimension of this operator, is changing as you go along the flow. So the dimension of psi changes here, but then keeps changing as you go back. It doesn't go back to where you were before.
But in terms of the Lagrangian, I don't see how, in terms of just field theory, forget about the bar, in terms of field theory, I don't see what is the difference between the beginning and the end.
Yeah, so
the same Lagrangian.
So, no, this is a function of epsilon.
No, forget about the bulk. Yeah, do you understand?
No, this is a function of epsilon. I mean this as a function of scale within the boundary field theory. So as you flow from the UV to the IR, the dimension of this operator is changing.
So are you changing how you quantize the theory? Because you have the same Lagrangian at the end. Are you changing something about the quantization procedure?
From the bulk perspective?
No, from the boundary.
You know, the boundary Lagrangian is defined purely in terms of the bulk.
But then you have the problem, you go back to the identical, the same.
No, you don't, because the boundary conditions you've imposed on the fermion are different at the end.
So you must be able to say that without the bulk, that's all. Yeah. How do you say it without the bulk?
I think so. But it can't be any other way because of the symmetries, because of power.
No, of course.
You get the form of the action would actually look different. If you wrote it out from the fundamental field.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It would look different.
Yeah.
It's not the same.
Right? But okay, sorry, this is not the same as this.
So what you mean by the coupling constant is also
Yeah. For example, in the scalar case, I think you would be tempted to write the following equality, where f is equal to 1. Right, it's the other fixed. I don't think this is strictly speaking a true equation, because the O this O that appears in there is not the same operator that appears in there. So that this is not the kind of equation that should be writing. You know, this theory flows to this theory. The operators change as you move. Is that looking at me like I'm I have to say that this also confused me for a long time when we computed this max.
So you're just saying that there is more G dependent than just G psi bar psi. Is that?
Yeah, the anomalous dimension psi has anomalous dimensions that depend on.
No, but those anomalous dimensions come from some dependence of L on G as well. Is that?
From L, sorry, what was L?
LCFT or L.
Comes the dependence of L
on G.
Presumably, yes. Sorry, you want to say there's G's sitting in there?
And some additional.
It's got to be more than just G's because this flow goes back to G from zero. And the central charge has to change. So
and then G is
This may be a good point to sort of tell you some of the technicalities of the boundary terms that I was sweeping under the carpet. Because there is something which doesn't return to where you start. Let me rub this down. Okay, so what are the boundary terms you need? So the usual boundary terms for the two CFTs take the following form. 3x is the induced metric on the boundary, and then there's an f psi bar psi, and f is equal to plus 1 and minus 1 for the CFT1 and the CFT2. Okay. So as you do undergo this flow, this f has to flow from minus 1 to plus 1. This f obeys an equation very much like this. 1 plus f, 1 minus f. Okay, this changes. But this f can't flow with this boundary condition from minus 1 to plus 1, because as you go along the flow, you don't impose a boundary term of this type with f not equal to plus or minus 1 would not impose conditions on only half the spinner degrees of freedom at the boundary. It would impose conditions on all four spinner degrees of freedom, and that's not allowed. So you have to add to this the following sign. Gamma 5 psi. This g is interpreted as this coefficient here. You can see it breaks parity, as indeed that has to. And the requirement of this whole boundary condition imposes conditions on only 2 degrees of freedom rather than 4 is f squared plus g squared is equal to 1. So you get some constraints like this. You then derive in this Wilsonian RG flow, a differential equation. Afterwards, you impose this. And this is the beta function that you get. OK, so there is something changing. This f is going from minus 1 to plus 1. G, however, just comes back to 0.
So, George, that equation is true all of the flow, or isn't it?
Which this equation here?
Yeah.
This equation has to be true all over the flow in order to have a well-defined dynamic system.
Sorry, from just the field theory point of view, why can't I add those two operators? This
doesn't correspond to a double trace operation in the boundary.
Okay.
This one does. The reason is that, you know.
Is this not the boundary action?
This is the boundary action of the bulk fields. But this is not the double trace operator. This is the double trace
operator. The some combination is the double trace
operator. No, it's actually this guy here. You know, you can look at this by. It's to do with the gamma matrix.
So you're saying F and G are tied together, so it's somehow the combination.
In some sense, yes. But you know, if you follow the Witten prescription for how you put on a double trace operator, you basically want to, combine the sources and responses in some particular way. And it's really this guy that does that. Not this.
If you had a real boundary theory with gauge fields, you might have thought along the flow as you break parity, you start generating Chern-Simons terms.
Huh?
Can you see that happening in the bulk?
It's a good question. I haven't looked.
I meant a boundary from Simon's from the gauge field.
Yeah, you know, this flow is not like that for a free theory, because usually, you know, when you integrate out a Dirac fermion, you're left with a Chern-Simons.
So
here you're not. Here parity is restored at the end, so it's a little different.
So probably F is changing the sign there.
F goes through.
J equals 0, J equals 1, and then you pick the other branch of the square root, right?
Exactly, right. That's why this sign
flips. So F goes.
Yeah, that's why this sign flips after G.
So that's why the action. Yeah.
This looks like a kind of a
In some sense, but really it's the only deformation you can add that
right,
breaks.
So then you're going from the side to side, minus side to side.
Yeah, you've got to go around, right? You can't go down, you've got to go around. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
In the beginning, you told us at some point an 84 is probably, you need to specify 84, but everything should apply in general D more or less, but this seems to be very...
Right, so we've done the following. We computed these beta functions for ADS4 and ADS5, for Dirac deformations, and also for Majorana deformations, psi. The difference between ADS4 and ADS5 is trivial calculationally. The difference between Majorana and Dirac deformations is a big deal calculationally, but you still get the same beta function. So this seems true for all of the fermionic deformations that we looked at. You know, in the scalar case, there was a large N argument that told you it was quadratic. There has to be some argument in the fermionic case that tells you this is what you always get. But now it's an all loops beta function. If I expand this out, it doesn't stop at one loop. It's tree level. Actually, there is no one loop term. You can understand that just by gamma matrices taking the trace and being zero. But you know, tree level, two loops, four loops, all loop beta function is captured there. So I don't know a large N argument that reproduces this. OK, other questions? Yeah. Sorry?
Can you say again why you said upside is not double case deformation?
Yeah, I can try to remember. It's basically Dirac issues. So psi is A alpha. One of these, roughly one of these is the response, one of these is the source. And to get the double trace deformation, you want the leading order term near the boundary to go as response-response, operator-operator. But that requires some massaging of gamma matrices to get this to hit this, not to get this to hit that. That's what this gamma 5 does.
It is sort of two loops if you think of G and F.
Yeah, so that's...
G times F.
There might be a way to think about it that way, with F being some
transformation
auxiliary field that you add in, and
that's right.
I agree.
That's G times.
Okay, I want to change tack slightly and tell you about yet another choice. So we have these two fixed points, and we know that there's a UV CFT, which I've called CFT2, and an IR CFT, which I've called CFT1, and there's a flow between them that we've just seen, which turning on these guys. Suppose that we want to preserve rotational symmetry, but we allow ourselves to break Lorentz symmetry when we start here. Now it turns out there's one other operator that you could also consider, and the other operator that's relevant, so we've got this guy. The other operator is this. So if you want some free field intuition, this is like a mass, this is like a chemical potential. So you can ask, what happens if I turn on linear combinations of this guy and this guy? Well, for most linear combinations that you turn on, so now the RG flow is some two-dimensional space, psi, but also this would be turning on this one. If you turn on this plus a little bit of this, it turns out you always flow back to this infrared fixed point. But there's one exception. So to see this exception, it turns out to be nice to look at the operators in the following combinations. No, you know, when I said chemical potential, I meant rather as an analogy. The real way to put on a chemical potential is to black hole and some gauge field. But so this is just a irrelevant operator. But it's an analogy I'll come back to, though, so it's worth stressing it's just an analogy. Okay, so if you look at these linear combinations of these two operators, and then you compute the beta functions for these guys, it turns out they're independent. So both G plus and G minus obey this with no mixing between them. What that means is that if you turn on just G plus that set G minus to zero, you get one flow. And if you turn on just G minus and set G plus to zero, you get another flow. When they stop, you've got two new fixed points. So actually, the full RG flow looks rather like this. Two new non-relativistic, because I turned on this operator, fixed points. Okay. So what I'd like to do in the last part of this talk is just tell you about some of the properties, the rather strange properties that these two fixed points have. So, okay, so the first thing to say is that if we go back to this kind of formula, it's very easy to see how these fixed points come about. We don't care about Lorentz invariants. The only Lorentz invariant options were either to fix A or to fix D. What happens here is we fix one component of A and one component of D. So we fix A1 and D2. That's one of them, and then A2 and D1 fix the other one. You can see that it breaks Lorentz invariants by looking at the dimensions of the operators. The dimension of the two components of the spinner are different. Remind me what they were. Okay, these are also the spin up and spin down components of the spinners. So the two spinners are different. Parity is broken. P and C are both broken. This fixed point. In fact, parity takes you from here to here. You can see that it just flips spin up and spin down.
So the boundary theory is true, Majorana spin down. What is
No, you don't have to use that language because it's not relativistic. So these are just it's got two complex Grassmann operators, psi 1 and psi 2. They have so the same number of degrees of freedom as same number of operators as Dirac spinner, but they have different dimensions. Okay, something that's interesting, which actually sort of harks back to what is related to something we were saying before. If you look at the sum of these two, this M cancels this M, so it's always three. So psi 1, psi 2 is a charged marginal operator. And so actually what happens is if you're sat at this fixed point, this RG flow preserves the symmetry which rotates the phase of the psi, the U1 global symmetry. If I turn on this, I break it, which means I come out of this board, but there's actually a circle of fixed points here. It turns out this is complex, so actually it's an S2, not a circle. This is kind of reminiscent of that circle that we saw from breaking chiral symmetry. And actually, this is a general phenomenon. These are somehow Goldstone operators. So the general phenomenon is the following. Whenever you have a symmetry in the bulk, global or gauged, or actually in this case, Lorentz, and you break that symmetry only by the boundary conditions you impose on the fields, you're guaranteed to get a marginal operator, which basically follows from Goldstone's theorem in the bulk, which is a double trace operator and sweeps out some fixed manifold, some manifold of fixed points. And the manifold of fixed points is of the form G mod H, where G is the symmetry that you had and H is the surviving symmetry after you broke.
So there are no Majorana fields in
the boundary? No Majorana fields.
This seems to break some global.
This would break global, right. So coming around here would break.
Back then the firm is an eventual theorem.
Correct. So I agree with the first statement, but why the second statement?
It's a global U1 token.
That's right.
Yeah. So if you identify that with some kind of charge, the fermions will have to be neutral.
I'm trying to understand. So this is charged. If I turn it on, the theory, right, the theory no longer has that global, that U1 symmetry. It's explicitly broken as I move around here.
Right, so you would expect the fermions then to be neutral relative to the charge.
There is no charge. It's broken.
Right. Well, it's like in a
superconductor. I'm not sure I understand, but maybe we can...
Yeah.
Maybe you can tell me this later. I know, as far as I know... As far as I can see, you turn this on, the U1's gone.
It's not broken. Breaking,
no, it's an explicit breaking in the boundary because you choose to turn it on.
So it looks, in that sense, it looks like a new field theory.
Okay. The fact that these are generic, but you know, this is clearly a large enough.
You call it the ghost, which I'm trying to see. To think about this, the face, some kind of face model.
Oh, you
want to
make this
coupling
dynamical?
I guess so, yes.
Okay, this mechanism is really a generic way to get marginal operators in the boundary. But marginal operators are very rare. And it seems like, well, there's two options. Either this is a large N artifact, which in most cases is clearly true, and will be lifted by 1 over N effects. But it's also kind of a robust way to generate marginal operators. So it would be very nice if there are certain situations where this remains marginal, even when quantum effects in the bulk are taking into account. So I think understanding how these marginal operators are lifted by 1 over n effects is something for future study.
Along this as two, the Lorentz invariance is restored?
No. The all of these theories break Lorentz invariance. Okay, finally, let me tell you about the really weird thing, which is when you look at the Green's functions. So I'll sit at one of these points where the charge is... where there is a U1 symmetry, but no Lorentz invariance. And we'll look at the Green's functions for these two operators. I'll write it in the time-like and space-like situations, just because there are people in the audience who know where the factors of I should go, and they're different in the two cases. So this is what the Green's function looks like. E to the pi I n plus a half c lambda squared minus a squared dot plus minus 1.
Is there a reason you still have omega k scaling that way once you break Lorentz invariance?
What is there a reason why time like and space like are different?
I'm just asking why it's omega squared minus k squared instead of some more general power.
Yeah, the real reason is that we've still got ADS4 as the background. So this system still has z equals 1 symmetry imposed upon us. So it's non-Lorentz invariant.
So probably one of Lorentz corrections shifts the tiny bit.
I think so. Right. In fact, I hope they do a lot, because the whole thing is borderline pathological. Let's see. K1 plus IK2, K1 minus IK2. Okay, so this is the Green's function. So 2x2 matrix, because we've got two operators. The powers here are different, which reflects the fact that these dimensions, the different dimensions all work. In the space-like case, minus 1 over omega plus epsilon. C is just some constant, a bunch of ratios of gamma functions, some constants. So this is 1 k1 plus ik2, k1 minus ik2. Okay, these are the Green's functions. Yeah.
It's basically like it can generate a chunk size in the book. In the boundary.
It will generate... Oh, why did you say that?
Because this looks like a P plus IK superconductor. Mm-hmm.
Because of these?
Yeah.
These are the... the least strange part of the whole. This just follows because it's k dot,
right.
And that's where this is coming from. So this is the bit that's sort of sensible.
Can you think of it as a superconductor with a big time versus symmetry? Then I would think it's, I mean, it's not necessary, but many times you can think of that as well. I mean, the owner literally might be.
That would be very interesting. I don't know if that's true or not. Sounds interesting. Let me tell you what's slightly weird about this. What's weird is the fact that there's a 1 over omega that sits in front of everything. So, if we look at the eigenvalues, well, it turns out that this has a nice property that the determinant is equal to 1. So the eigenvalues come in reciprocal pairs. So one of the eigenvalues goes as 1 over omega, and the other eigenvalue goes as omega, with a bunch of other k and omega dependent stuff on both. This is odd. This is saying that there's an omega equals 0 pole for all values of the spatial domain. So there's a name for this in the kinetic mathematical literature. It's what's called a flat band. Okay, so what's a flat band? A flat band is where you have a situation where the kinetic energy of an excitation is completely suppressed. That's what we're seeing here. So any spatial momentum, there's an excitation that costs you no energy. The simplest example of a flat band is really familiar. It's just a Landau level. You know, the magnetic field makes particles go in circles. You get huge degeneracies in Landau levels for precisely this reason. But here, there's no magnetic field. And getting a flat band in the absence of a magnetic field is fairly exotic, but also interesting.
Is it compressible?
Sorry?
Is it compressible or
incompressible? Is it compressible? Yeah. It's a vacuum state of some field theory.
Does it have a
gap? No,
is there a conserved charge which is associated with,
right,
with rotations of slide
field? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, there is one?
Yes.
And it's related to this screw.
Yeah, exactly. It's a thing that would have been broken had I turned on this operator, but I chose not.
Right. So this is related to this question. You can think of the three factors as some kind of scalar field, which has some phase factor, which is some S2 that allows you to rotate.
No, I don't. This is just a single marginal operator. Here I've got an infinite number of zero modes in the bulk. So they're tied together, but I don't think this implies.
Well, that
like
usually this in conventional field theory is good for.
Okay, I don't have too much more to say. Okay, so this is rather peculiar. The reason people are interested in this is the following, that if you can have a large degeneracy, so you've got lots of basically local excitations. Worth saying, this is a form of local criticality, but very different from the z equals infinity local criticality that you get from ADS2. Z equals 1 setup. So usually what happens with flat bands is you throw in lots of particles, you have a huge degeneracy of where to put them, but that degeneracy is lifted by small effects, which drives the system to some interesting, strongly coupled phase. Of course, this is ADS-CFT. We don't have any need to drive the system to strongly coupled phases. It's there from the beginning. And it's kind of curious that this is emerging. Yes, and I'm sure. I hope that 1 over n corrections will kill this, and it will be very interesting to understand.
Because of the coupling to the z equals 1 bulk, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a couple of mechanisms that I know of that could kill this, will kill this. But exactly how much of it survives at large n, large but finite, I think is interesting. I should stress. I really don't have very much intuition for this. For why this is emerging at all. I'll give you the one small thing that I know of, which is probably bad intuition because it comes from free fermions. So from free fermions, if you had a massless free fermion, this is the Dirac cone, and a chemical potential that sits here, and then you were to add this deformation that I added, which was psi bar psi 1 plus gamma 0 psi. So what does this do? This adds a mass, the first term, which gaps it. This adds a chemical potential, which pushes the chemical potential right to the bottom of this band. So one would expect a massless mode to go to omega equals k squared. You kill the linear term. But we're still in ADS4, so this large N soup of stuff is insisting on Z equals 1, so it's killing this as well. So it seems that this is the only sort of fairly crappy intuition that I have for why this is arising. Okay, so Z equals 1, fixed by the background.
Is it killing it, or is it just dominating over it?
This term can't be there by the scaling symmetry of the problem.
Isn't there the charge density's order of one?
Good. So the charge density, yes. I haven't computed it. Again, it would be a 1 over n effect. All of this is at zero temperature, zero chemical potential. I appreciate I'm running short on time. We've done the simulations at finite temperature and finite bulk chemical potential, meaning Rice and Nordstrom black holes. This thing still survives in a way I'll be happy to explain it.
So you don't get some singularity at a particular point, which is some critical point.
Some critical point.
As you worry this chemical potential, as you worry the black hole charge.
Yeah, let me show you what actually happens. You see, these guys are all outside the light cone. These are really equal zero objects. So, when we do these lovely Mathematica simulations, this is what it looks like on calculator. This is omega, this is k, there's a huge pole, omega equals zero, and this, at finite temperature, this drops down like this.
So what are you plotting here?
I'm plotting the Green's function in this direction. The imaginary part. You can plot the real part as well. And this drops down at some k, which is a little bigger than the temperature. So this is mu equals zero finite t. If I look at mu not equal to zero, but t equals zero, the first thing that happens is the flat band gets shifted. It gets shifted to basically omega equals minus mu, and then it survives. It starts to disperse a little bit. It bends in, but as it bends in, it also gets very broad.
This mu is now for a bulk U1 that you've introduced and coupled to the Fermi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Meanwhile, if I crank up the charge big enough, you start to get the usual Fermi surface story, where Fermi surfaces arise. They have fairly nice dispersion relations. They seem to have nothing whatsoever to do with this flat line. So what's happening here, you've still got zero energy states in a system of finite temperature. It's kind of strange, but having talked to Hong and Tom on Friday, I think sort of I understand this a little bit better, but basically these states were outside the light. So if you crank up the temperature, they didn't have anywhere to do decay. So this is why these are states. So said in a slightly more physical way, you've got a soup of stuff going around at temperature T with momentum of order T, and they're not, well, by momentum conservation, they're not sort of hitting these states enough to destroy them. These states are at very high momentum. Okay, I think I'll leave it there.
They will still give you some large contribution to the entropy.
Presumably, right, although you're not seeing it in these sort of simple calculations of just turning on a background black hole. So I think all of these go under the general rubric of 1 over n effects, which means quantum effects of this fermion in the bulk, to understand how this very strange situation gets accepted.
Even at zero temperature, probably the 1 over n effects change. They break the ADS axonometries, right?
Exactly, right. You've got Lorentz breaking boundary conditions. There's loop effects, which should feed in and change ADS. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thanks for your attention.
Do you need the fermions to get to these non-relativistic things? Can you just consider, for example, a vector and some epsilon coupling, let's say, in 2 plus 1?
So that's right, you could flip a zero quantization, but leave AI in the usual Neumann way. I know Andreas looked at this in the context of quantum effects in the bulk. I guess that's kind of still ongoing, but it's certainly true that you don't get any weird pathologies like this.
No, I just mean the non-relativistic fixed.
That you can do with vectors. Yeah.
Do you have a flow of this in this case, or is it just separate, two separate fixed points in the vector case?
Also in the vector case?
Probably not.
I think you have a flow, yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned this comparison to the free fermions. Is something interesting happening here when delta minus goes to 1? Because that I would think, would be the regime where you would compare those three fermions.
You mean, as you start to get the unitarity?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the operator becomes, has dimension one, so it's like three fermions in a way.
Yeah, I wonder, you still get this general scaling of the eigenvectors. There's some stuff in here that certainly depends on delta plus and delta minus. I can check
easily
after the talk.
What is
the
scaling
symmetry,
but it's not
relativistic? Z equals 1, left shift stable. You've got rotations, but you have models. So you don't have a
relationship. Just out of curiosity, why do you keep calling this pathological, in the sense that I thought in the other community for this workshop, they started writing down lattice models that do this, and they're very interested in them?
That's nice.
So if they have real lattice models, it actually happen.
Okay.
And those are usually fine
theory. Of course. Yeah.
Otherwise, this won't happen.
I'll tell you why I think this is pathological. It's like the following term. You go to a swimming pool, and you take the water, and you mold it into a statue of your favorite person, and you stand back, and it just sits there. That's where a flat band is, right? There's no gradient energy. If that's not stupid, I don't know. Because it's a fermion, so you get to make your favorite statue exactly one atom thick. It's going along just one atom each, but it's not usual, right? It's very bizarre.
Thank you again.